Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
To combine the messages behind Mental Awareness Month and Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, we're going to talk about the intersection of the two with clinical psychologist Jenny T. Wang, the author of Permission to Come Home, Reclaiming Mental Health as Asian Americans. According to Wang's research, Asian Americans are the racial group in the U.S. least likely to seek mental health care. She notes that some of the cultural beliefs meant to protect family and communities, like all-encompassing respect for elders or the stress of saving face, might not be conducive to living an authentic life in the 21st century. Dr. Wang writes in her book, "Several barriers keep us, as children of Asian immigrants, from learning the necessary skills to relate to our emotions in more effective and positive ways. Some of them are cultural, while others are impacted by various narratives and stereotypes that have been placed on us and people who look like us. Our parents, in their best efforts to equip us for this world, may have tried to shield us in the best ways that they knew, which was to teach us how to harden ourselves to the ups and downs of emotions. As immigrants with limited language abilities, it may have been easier to shut down emotional responses in order to show up for work and deal with a racist boss, or to push through the grief and sadness of losing a parent halfway across the world and not having the money to travel home to attend their funeral. The suppression of emotion may have been the most effective tool that they had in their emotional toolkit, which is why they pass it along to you and me." The lack of mental health care for Asian Americans is especially noteworthy given the last 2 years. A recent study by the Asian American Psychological Association found more than 40% of Asian Americans reported anxiety and depression during the pandemic, and that is up from 10% before 2020. This comes as the last few years have seen a dramatic rise in hate crimes against Asian Americans. With me now to discuss Permission to Come Home, Reclaiming Mental Health as Asian Americans, and to take your calls is psychologist Jenny T. Wang. Dr. Wang, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, specifically Asian American listeners, what questions do you have for Dr. Jenny Wang about addressing mental health? How do you think the stereotype of Asian Americans in this country as a model minority has affected how you see yourself? Our number is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or you can tweet to us or send us a DM at @allofitWNYC for both. And children of immigrants can weigh in too. How do you think your position as a child or grandchild of immigrants has affected how you think about mental health? How did your parents raise you to think about emotions or failure or success? 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. We'd love you to join this conversation. Again, you can also reach out on Twitter at @allofitWNYC or Instagram if you'd like to remain anonymous. That's also at @allofitWNYC. So Dr. Wang, in each chapter in this book starts with the word question. Permission to question, permission to feel, permission to rage, permission to say no, permission to take up space, et cetera, et cetera. Why that word choice? Why was permission the word you wanted to use?
Within Asian culture, there is a strong sense of wanting to really defer or honor our elders, our parents, our community, right? We are so relationally oriented, and it's one of the most beautiful parts of being a part of the Asian culture. However, in that sense of deference, we almost feel as though we need to seek permission from these people in our lives in order to live the life that feels authentic, in order to marry the partners we may love, in order to pursue careers that, you know, we feel as though people expect us to pursue. And so I think this book really was framed on this idea that perhaps we can actually claim permission in these different spaces of our lives, and that perhaps we are part of that equation in terms of how we decide to make decisions and how we live out our lives that feel aligned with the values that we care about.
You write about this idea of swallowing emotions, an expression called swallowing your bitterness, and it's actually seen as a sign of strength, you explain. What are some steps someone can take to unlearn this practice and build some emotional literacy rather than just swallowing it?
Absolutely. You know, I always say that we don't necessarily think that swallowing it is always a bad thing. When you're under a stressor or when there's an imminent threat, you might need to avoid or suppress your initial response so that you can do the next tangible step, right, in order to protect yourself. But when we use the swallowing of emotion as a long-term strategy, that becomes highly problematic. And so one of the things we can think about is when we have space, when our bodies have regulated and have calmed down from the stressor, can we circle back to that emotion, such as anger, sadness, disappointment, and be curious about what that emotion is trying to tell us? Because our emotions serve as data, and it points to areas in our lives where we want to be curious, we want to explore, because sometimes that knowledge then informs how we want to make decisions or live our lives.
Yeah, you make a distinction about anger specifically, that anger in itself is not necessarily bad. It can sometimes be about protection. It's what we do with it, the anger afterward, that could make a potential problem. What are some things we can do so that anger doesn't become a potential problem?
Mm-hmm. You know, anger is one of those emotions where I say it is the emotion that protects us from injustice, protects us from people crossing our boundaries. So I think when we think about anger, we have to consider that there is the experience of anger as an emotional state, and then there's the expression of anger. And so I always tell my clients, let's widen the gap between our experience of the anger and how we act on it. Because sometimes when it's reactive, we may act on our anger in ways that we can't control or we're not aware of. And so when we feel the anger, can we first name it? Ooh, this person said something to me, and that has made me very angry. And then can I say, okay, hold on. Let me take a few breaths. Let me notice how my body is being activated here and give myself a pause so I can really think about how I want to respond in this moment. And sometimes that pause is only a couple seconds. And sometimes as we practice, it gets longer and longer, but that allows us to self-regulate our bodies and then be intentional about our expression of anger, which then helps us make sure that we don't hurt people or put ourselves in compromising situations.
My guest is Dr. Jenny T. Wang. The name of the book is Permission to Come Home, Reclaiming Mental Health as Asian Americans. Let's take some phone calls. Line one is Vijay calling in from Queens. Hi, Vijay. Thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Thank you for having me.
You are on the air. Get close to your speaker, though, so we can hear you.
Is it better now?
A little bit better, a little louder.
Yes.
There you are. Perfect.
I was calling to really chime in on the topic here. Mental health in my community, my homeland where I was born, this has not been something that has been discussed, especially when it comes to men, right? Men has often been told or expected to suck it up and don't talk about emotions and, tough it out. And I have seen over time the detrimental effect it has had on generations where they turn to drugs and alcohol or to anger, to violence, in outbursts, in ways to express themselves. Whereas I feel the need for mental health therapies and the intervention in my community, it's not there, but we are trying to change that right now.
Vijay, thank you for calling in. Dr. Wang, did you want to comment on Vijay's?
Yes, thank you so much for pointing out kind of the intersectionality of mental health, that right, gender is also part of how we're socialized to address mental health concerns, or even to acknowledge that we're struggling, we're not happy, we're feeling depressed. And so I think there's the cultural element and then the gendered element. And I agree with you that especially in Asian American men or children of immigrants who are also men, there are not many spaces for men to really explore their mental health, to admit that they are struggling, or to really be vulnerable. And I think that exacts a very costly toll to a lot of men in our communities.
Let's talk to Prav on line two, calling in from Elizabeth, New Jersey, who is a medical student. Hi, Prav.
Hi. I'm a fourth year medical student pursuing psychiatry next year. And I guess like I feel with this like millennial generation and the ones following, like there has been with improvements in education, like I feel kind of like a feedback loop where children and now like adults are talking to their parents about mental health. And I feel like with improvements in education, they've been more receptive of acknowledging it. And I think we're actually on a right track of with more people being aware of it, especially in the South Asian society, being more open to it.
Thank you so much, Prav, for calling in. Let's go to Michael calling in on line 3 from Harlem. Hi, Michael. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hi. How are you?
I'm great. I want to hear your story.
I am a first generation. I came from the Dominican Republic about 10 years ago to the U.S., and I've been living in Harlem ever since then. And something that I do can relate about the conversation on mental health is that, you know, growing up, it was like, I used to be like a kid that used to cry a lot. Mm-hmm. And my parents, especially my dad, you know, like coming from a Latino culture, he would be like, you have to tough it up. Like, man, like, you know, basically telling me, you know, this is a cruel place, like the world and the U.S. is like a very cruel place. You cannot be crying for anything, you know, like to the point now that I have grown up and I'm almost 30 years old. It's pretty much almost impossible for me to cry. And mm-hmm. I don't know if the doctor can say something about this, but it's, and sometimes it has affected me so much the inability to cry that, you know, like I go, you know, I express my feelings in other ways and which I sometimes I think are not the most healthiest mm-hmm. ones.
Let's get Dr. Wang in on this. Michael, first of all, thank you so much for sharing your story. Dr. Wang, any thoughts for Michael on that idea of not being able to express sadness, especially when, and you address this, when your parents, you realize your parents have given up so much for you to be here, and you recognize that they've had a hard struggle, and they're really just trying to protect you.
Yes. And I think that narrative is so strong in many immigrant cultures, right? That for our parents, if they cried, that didn't necessarily solve their problems, right? They mm-hmm. still had to show up to work the next day. They still had to live their lives. And so there was a sense that the expression of that emotion wasn't going to fix anything. And so why bother, right? But I think what was missing is that there are actually, it's a biologic way in which our body processes stress. So when we cry, when we express even just the tears, it allows the body actually to return to a homeostasis, or at least to release some of that tension. And so many of my clients share a very similar struggle that they haven't cried in perhaps years. And I think that's okay, because in many ways you're fighting against decades or years of that mentality that I need to hold it together. And so sometimes what I may do is when I know I need a good cry, but I can't seem to get it there, I might watch a particularly sad movie that I know there's a certain part where really kind of pushes that button a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then I just am keen to my body. I'm noticing how my body is processing the movie and the content. And I might just follow it where it leads. It may not always lead to kind of a sobbing session, but it allows us to be a little bit closer to that emotional state. And sometimes that starts to soften some of those narratives. And I would say that when you feel that softening, can you start to be the parent that you wish you had? Can you say to yourself, it's okay to cry, that this is actually a sign of strength? This is a way in which your body and mind are trying to move through this strong emotion. And sometimes we need to engage in that reparenting process.
Oh, I love that idea of using art as the conduit between not being able to show your emotions and letting it be the bridge to showing your emotions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
My guest is Dr. Jenny T. Wang. The name of the book is Permission to Come Home, Reclaiming Mental Health as Asian Americans. We are taking your calls, specifically Asian American listeners. What questions do you have for Dr. Wang about addressing mental health? How do you think your position as a child or grandchild of immigrants has affected the way you think about mental health? We'll open it up for all sorts of folks there. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, Twitter and Instagram at All of It WNYC. We'll take more of your calls and we'll have more with Dr. Wang after a quick break. This is All of It. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest is Dr. Jenny T. Wang. Her book is called Permission to Come Home, Reclaiming Mental Health as Asian Americans. You are my guest as well, listeners. So let's talk to Dan, calling in from Brooklyn. Hi, Dan. Thank you so much for calling in.
Hi. I want to emphasize the characteristic of science, because as both a neuroscientist and a neurosurgeon, I think we have two phases here that would be very important in this discussion. Mm-hmm. One is when we discover relationships between phenomena, and that's the phenomenological side of the science. That's a primitive beginning stage, which more often than not is disproven. Then there is the other side, which is the mechanistic, where when we understand the mechanisms of how phenomena occurs, then we are able to manipulate it. And that's when we become real scientists or real clinicians or whatever we claim to be. And I'm really afraid that the stresses and problems created by corona and isolation and all of these things, which are very, very real, are being compounded by this phenomenological have-it-as-you-want-it notions of mental illness and mental conditions. Hmm. And as you can see in the worst form in psychiatry, where they just give you a pill without really knowing what it does, it just right. seems to change the symptoms. And this is a dangerous approach to take. And I really think that we should focus much more on how much we don't understand and how much self-discipline really, really, really helps.
Dan, thank you so much. I want to let Dr. Wang weigh in here. Sounds like Dan has a different philosophy about this than you do.
I kind of agree. I agree with what he's saying in terms of how sometimes we may utilize medication to kind of dampen or remove symptomatology that is driven by deeper, right, pain, deeper symptoms, deeper issues, right? And so I think somebody who's feeling depressed, there could be many reasons for that. But if we use the medication alone to remove those depression symptoms, but not address maybe the childhood trauma or the pain that is driving those depression symptoms, then we kind of leave people perhaps one with a kind of more numbed sense of their world and also not addressing those deeper rooted kind of issues. So I kind of hear that piece where I would agree. I think we should take a multifactorial approach in our treatment to mental health. And I think that people deserve more than necessarily just fixing the symptom, but not addressing those root causes.
You know, I alluded to this a little bit earlier. Many children of immigrants know how hard their parents work to make it in the country. And it can be easy to compare your suffering to the level of your parents' suffering. And I think you can brought out this out to anybody who has had some sort of privilege, feeling like they can't express their emotional pain or suffering. Sometimes we have a saying in my house, no crying on the yacht. Sometimes that's accurate, but sometimes you need to cry. How can we reframe this push-pull of I have so much, so I shouldn't feel bad?
Yes, I think that we can hold both in existence, right? We can hold both in the sense that we can fully acknowledge and validate that our parents truly struggled. And I can also honor my own struggles, be it related to mental health or just misalignment in the way that I'm living my life. And that when I honor my sense of misalignment or my struggle, it actually helps me identify where the road leads next. Because if I'm feeling depressed, right, I could sit in that for the next few years of my life, or I could actually say, you know what, let me think about how I might address this difficulty, either, you know, medication, community supports, finding a therapist, exercising, right? I can actually see that these symptoms are more just red flags again that are telling me that perhaps there's a different way to engage my life. And also see that our parents struggle. It may feel like a burden in the sense that we need to somehow repay it, or we need to somehow be grateful. But perhaps their struggle was a gift that allows us the privilege of being able to take care of our mental health. It allows us to have the resources to pursue a life that is more balanced.
You write, many Asian American clients have a strong and complicated relationship with the word duty when it comes to relation to their parents. Some carry this responsibility proudly and lovingly as an overflow of their sense of affection and gratitude to their parents. For others, it can prompt a sense of resentment or obligation that they must hold in tandem with their own needs and wants. What are some good questions to ask yourself if you find yourself in that position?
Absolutely. I think especially for Asian Americans who are in that kind of 30 to 40 age group, we're kind of, if you have your own family and your own children and you have parents who, you know, are still living, we're kind of in that sandwich generation where we might feel torn between the needs of our family as well as our aging parents. And so one of the things that I kind of encourage my clients to think about is, you know, what are the boundaries that exist between my capacity to be a good daughter, to take care of my parents, while also having capacity for myself and my family and children? And that we are not these infinite wells of capacity, unfortunately. And so something has to give. And often as children of immigrants, one of the first things that gives is ourselves. We say, let's just give it all to the people we love, and we don't take care of ourselves, which makes it hard for us to show up well in all of those spaces as well.
My guest is Dr. Jenny T. Wang. The name of her book is Permission to Come Home, Reclaiming Mental Health as Asian Americans. Let's get through a few more calls. On line two, I think it's Shaylin calling in from New Jersey. Hi, Shaylin.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. I'm doing well. Tell us your story or share it, please.
Yeah, sure. And thanks for taking my call. So I thought I would share my personal story. I moved to America at early age. And I think there was a comment about this sort of approval that you need from your parents or higher up in the family. In my case, you know, I wanted to marry my girlfriend. And in our culture, she belonged to a different caste. And because of that, you know, that relationship was kind of disapproved by my parents. And I went through a very huge struggle for almost 7 years trying to convince them. And at the end, we ended up, you know, breaking our relationship apart because we knew that, you know, it's not going to be accepted by the family. It was very heartbreaking for me and went through a kind of a lot of mental stress and kind of emotional roller coaster. Eventually, my parents wanted to marry me with another girl, so I got engaged. Immediately after that, I realized that that relationship was so artificial to me, and I had to kind of, you know, back it off. And I told my parents that, you know, I cannot continue. I cannot really marry this girl because really my heart is not set there. And that was like a nuclear explosion moment in my family where I went through a lot of emotional stress and kind of trauma. Eventually, I was kicked out of the family and pretty much, you know, I was on my own. And I'm happy to say that, you know, at the end, my family did sort of, you know, provide a consent and accepted my relationship with my girlfriend. And I'm happily married for now more than 15 years. I have now two kids. But as a parent of my young kids, I always see that how Asian culture at times imposes things on young kids and sets the boundaries without the realization of how much mental stress or trauma it could cause them. So I just thought like it would be good to kind of share the story for anybody listening your show.
Shaylin, thank you so much for calling and thank you for sharing that story. We really, really appreciate it. Dr. Wang, I saw you were with me as we were following Shaylin's story.
Well, first of all, how much courage did it take, right, to really step into that space and tell your family, this is not for me, right? And I imagine in Asian culture, there's so much pressure and wanting to please, wanting to honor our parents. And so, I mean, I'm just amazed at his courage in being able to do that. And then also to realize that sometimes those conflicts, right, are places in which perhaps we might need to meddle through and walk through in order for our families and ourselves to grow. And I think that, you know, I'm so glad that they were able to get married and to have kids. And how amazing that when we persist in being authentic in who we are, even if there's pushback, that in the end, we know that there's alignment there. And I think that's what allows us to build sustainable lives.
Let's talk to Benjamin calling in from Trumbull, Connecticut. Hi, Benjamin. Thank you for calling in.
Hi. Yes. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm a child of, Chinese immigrants, from Taiwan. And, so growing up as an Asian American, definitely, felt the pull and the tension between, my own native culture with American culture. And, I know we've been talking a lot about, duty, that sense of duty. And I guess my question was, what are practical steps of healing as adults now that we can, take to begin that healing process of between relationships with our parents, but also letting go of that sense of duty or increased responsibility that I think, especially for Asian American parents, they tend to place or Asian immigrant parents that place on their children.
Benjamin, thank you. That's a terrific question. It's going to have to be our last one, so I'll let you take it, Dr. Wang.
Okay. I think what Benjamin's referring to is that idea of filial piety, right? One's a child's sense of duty or honor to their parents and the actions they take to live out that sense of honor and respect. And I think that one thing I would, encourage, people to consider is that duty, it can be seen as a burden. It can be seen as something where, I can't say no, I have to comply, I have to do what my parents expect of me. Or we could see it as the beginning of conversations and negotiation. That duty doesn't have to be either or, but it can be a spectrum within which we find a middle ground in which our parents can be taken care of, and we can also honor ourselves and the lives that we're building.
My guest has been Dr. Jenny T. Wang. She's got a social media account, Asians for Mental Health, so the conversation can continue there. And the name of her book is Permission to Come Home, Reclaiming Mental Health as Asian Americans. Dr. Wang, thank you for spending so much time with us and for taking our listeners' calls.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a pleasure.